Hello and welcome to another episode of The Brand Called You, a podcast and video show that brings you leadership lessons and wisdom from hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. I'm your host, Lisa Lipkin, and if you're new to the channel, please subscribe and hit the bell icon. So, you know, usually when you say the word successful person, I think the image that comes to mind is somebody who makes a ton of money or who's famous or both, you know, like a best-selling author, a CEO of a Fortune 500 company. But to be perfectly honest, lately, I'm absolutely fascinated by a different kind of prototype. I call them the unsellers. These are these very special, unique individuals who aren't necessarily striving to get a million hits on Instagram, but instead they find tremendous satisfaction in impacting one person, a person whose passions are so contagious that they end up affecting an entire community. And I think that today's guest is just such a person. And I'm delighted to welcome today Ariel Zeitlin. Ariel is a library. She's a librarian, but she's also a librarian at the Montclair Public Library, which is a suburb about 14 miles from New York City. And she is a fascinating woman. I have to say, Ariel, that, you know, first of all, my image of a reference librarian, which you do just a couple of hours a week in Montclair, is very different than what you have shown me a librarian to be. I think about those images from my childhood where they all had, well, they had glasses as you do, but they were not nearly as fashionable. And they had sensible shoes. And I remember they were all very excited and very obsessed with the Dewey Decimal System. But it was primarily showing you where the books are and how to find them. But I think today's librarian is so incredibly different. And you've proven that to me. I think the thing that particularly fascinates me about you is actually something you said to me. You said to me that every single thing you do comes in handy at some point in your work. And the reason I find this fascinating, and I want to tell viewers about this, is I think you took a very circuitous road to get to be a librarian. You didn't start out that way. You came to it a little later in life. Ariel started out doing so many different hats, a travel writer, a movie producer and writer and all sorts of things surrounding movies. You worked as a travel writer, among other things. And you even worked as a curator, curating an incredible show about war rugs woven by women who witnessed war. And all of that somehow, I think, led you to librarianship. And I'd love to hear about how all of those various hats maybe informed what you do today to start with. I know it's a heavy question, but welcome. And I'd love to hear from you.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Lisa. It's exciting to be here. And I do want to put in a plug for Sensible Shoes because it's one of the reasons I love being a librarian.
Well, you know that one of my favorite writers, I think it was J.D. Salinger, said the reason he chose to be an author was because he could wear his workaday clothes and his comfortable shoes. So,
well, it's definitely true that the comfortable shoes are almost as good as the books. I've always been a writer myself, and I've always really appreciated writing and reading. And so everything that I do is along the cause of promoting that in one way or another. And I work on the reference desk two or three, I certainly every day, a couple hours a day. And it's a little bit like the emergency room. You never know who's going to walk in. And by the time somebody gets to a library to a reference desk in this time in history, when information is so much more democratic than it was in the old days, it's so much easier to Google something than it used to be. But the problem is that when you Google something, you get thousands and thousands of answers. And so your librarian is sort of your guide who helps you find what you really want And that's different.
You're kind of like a certain type of therapist.
In a way. I mean, we also are, we joke around that we're like familiar, we're the familiar stranger, like a bartender. People tell librarians things that they wouldn't tell anybody else.
Really?
Well, yes, they'll tell you all about their feud with their neighbor and how they're, you know, they're trying to research the town ordinances against low-hanging branches over their yard or something. And then they'll start telling you about their neighbor. You have to figure out how to cut them off at the pass.
What was the strangest request that you can remember in recent years?
Oh gosh, I don't know. I think some of the funniest ones are when people will come in at the last minute, like a student or something, and they'll say, I need to find out everything about Frantz Fanon real quick. And you're like, I have 15 minutes. We're closing. No, I can't do this. Come back tomorrow. But really what is, I don't know if this really answers your question, but I actually do, my specialty is different from most librarians. There are a lot of different ways to be a good librarian. You can be a local historian, you can be a genealogist, you can be someone who does knowledge mapping. You can be like someone who's a terrific technology teacher. But I get to be a literary librarian, and that's really special. I run a series with top authors, best-selling authors, talking about, they're in conversation about their new books. And although Montclair is a suburb of the city, it's a big favorite with New York Times people, people who work at the staffers at the New Yorker, and literary types. So we have this amazing advisory board that brings great writers to Montclair. So this past year we had Isabel Wilkerson, who wrote Cast. We had Charles Blow of the New York Times, who wrote The Devil You Know. We had Ann Patchett for The Dutch House. Jhumpa Lahiri, the names, not she wrote The Namesake originally, but this was Whereabouts, her first book in 10 years. And so I actually get to meet authors, although it's the format of the show has changed because of the pandemic. And that's what I mean when I say everything I ever did comes in handy. So everyone I ever met, all of the writers I worked with in other, when I was working in magazines or books, or has come in handy. The curation, the ideas about curation have come in handy. And most of all, film. I mean, I never thought I would be on air, and I never wanted to be on air.
Because, you're on air?
Well, I mean, I sort of MC these online conversations. And I introduce the writers, I help find their conversation partners. And sometimes the conversation partners are as interesting as the writers. Well, we try to find a really good pairing. Like we had Sandra Cisneros, who wrote The House on Mango Street, and Chiara Alegria Yudes, who wrote the screenplay and the book for In the Heights. And so we had them as a pairing, and it turned out that that Chiara had always idolized Sandra as a young writer. And so that was very exciting. So these are some of the ideas about curating that really come into play from my past life. And then I was the one who decided to take the series online when we were all in lockdown.
So that was the COVID, the only blessing about COVID was this, right? Because you...
Well, yes. I mean, the funny thing is that actually a lot of writers I've talked to in service of the program that I run have said that it doesn't make very much difference to their lives because they just spend all their time at home alone anyway. They're living with the characters in their heads. And sometimes their loved ones find it very upsetting. And to them, it was just like everybody was staying at home like they should.
You said something beautiful in preparing for this interview. You said that why you love doing this so much is that it's about creating and enhancing a community of readers. Could you elaborate on that a bit?
Well, sure. I mean, the only thing better than reading a great book that you're really enthusiastic about is sharing it. And I do think that the books that we read and the ideas that we hold bring us together. They unite us with other people. And I don't know if you've ever had this experience, but sometimes I'll be on a train or somewhere and I'll see that someone is reading my favorite book or my recent favorite book, because it's pretty hard to have a favorite book when you're a librarian. And I feel like I know them.
Yes.
So it brings people together and it can have a tremendous ripple effect. And, you know, there are all different kinds of book clubs. I also run book clubs. That's another of my specialties.
Well, I should mention to our audience members that not only do you run book clubs, but you have a fan club that follows you from library to library as you change jobs. I happen to know that you ran a coffee and crime mystery club when you were in, I believe it was Livingston, New Jersey. Mm-hmm. And you have passionate followers who are willing to drive during a rush hour traffic jam on the New Jersey Turnpike just to participate in your other clubs. I'll just mention to the viewers that some of your other clubs, which I just love, the Read Around the World book club. I attended one that you ran in New York City, which was based on New York City stories. It was a New York City based book club. And apparently, according to your information, you're about to start one based on the Everything Bagel called the Everything Book Club.
Right. Yes.
So tell me about these clubs and what they do for the community.
You know, what's always so interesting to me about a book club, especially in the beginning when you, it is true and it is insanely flattering to me that some of my book club members have been with me for 10 years and more, and that they've come to me. This is the third library they've come to me for. And I can't say, I'm sure there are other librarians who are also good at running book clubs. I don't really know why it's me, but I think it's because I enjoy them so much.
My listeners and just to describe to us just a little bit how a book club works at a library so they get a picture of it.
Well, book clubs are super popular. So, I mean, many people belong to one. And in fact, if you belong to one, you often belong to two or three. So what you do is you all read the same book and you get together and you talk about it. And I have my current book club, which is the Coffee and Crime, which is about to turn into the Everything Book Club. Mostly because I felt like since the pandemic, it's been harder for me to read about crime so much.
Ah, yeah. So you try to choose books. I think that personally is your secret, is the books you choose are fueled by your own personal passions. You're not really thinking with your head as much as your heart. And I think people get excited about that.
Well, I do. When I read a book for a book club, I have to read it as a reader. I don't think about how the book is built. And I say built rather than written or made, because I think writers build books. They have to lay down the path for what will follow. They have to do foreshadowing. Otherwise, you're like, wait, how did we wind up here? And that's especially true, of course, of mystery novels. There have to be many things in a book. You know, a short story usually only has one theme. A book is more of like a vast meta-like expanse where there can be different vignettes and different ideas running through it and different threads. So, going back to what we do at the book clubs, what makes a book club? So what people will say to me sometimes about my book clubs, as opposed to an unofficial book club where you get together at your friend's house and you just drink wine or something, is that it can
sometimes don't even read the book.
Well, the conversation can kind of slide over into being about the hostess's slipcovers or whatever. Whereas I prepare a list of questions, some of which I'll look and see what else is out there. And but I read the book at least twice and sometimes three times. So I have to really like the book. Mm-hmm. And right now, I feel like I don't really want to read about sociopaths three times. Like I'm becoming more hard-boiled again. I can read tougher books again, but for a while I really didn't want to do that. And yes, it's true that I do love all of the books that we talk about. I don't think there's any reason. And for everybody out there, if you ever are reading a book and you don't enjoy it, just throw it across the room. Don't keep reading.
I have a friend who used to read the first two pages and then it would either get flipped across the room against the kitchen wall, he lived in a studio, or not. And I always thought that was a great gauge.
Well, sometimes if a lot of people I know really like a book, I'll give it a second chance because it can be a mood thing too. You know, sometimes it's like we always say there's a book for every reader, but there's also a book for every mood. So anyway, I try to give people something extra. So oftentimes it'll be like a little snippet of, I'll play a snippet of an interview with an author, or I'll find out more about a particular topic. So I remember I did one about, we were doing a mystery novel about somebody who was an unwitting witness to a crime and was hunted down by the people who were the murderers. And I researched what were the factors that made you more and less likely to become the victim of a crime, to be caught into some kind of crime scenario. Do you want to know what they are?
Yes.
Well, the first one that really hit me, where I was like, oh my God, I have to change this immediately, was if you work in a public place and you have your first and your last name on your identifying badge, you're much more likely to become the focus of some kind of sociopath because they can track you down. So I immediately went and changed my badge to just say Ariel and not Ariel Zeitlin.
Oh.
People would be less, well, because especially Ariel Zeitlin is kind of unusual. The other thing is, taking out money from an ATM that doesn't have, you know, like a little room, like a little box around it.
Oh,
why? Because when people see you taking out money, they could follow you. So these are different kinds of crimes, but they're all crimes of opportunity. So what you want to do is you want to reduce the opportunity. The other thing is, and this one I didn't have any problems with, because I am so good in my old age, is sex. It's your sex life.
What?
So the more extramarital affairs you have, whether you're married or the other person is married, and the more times you have relations with that person, and the more partners you have, all of these factors make you more and more likely to become the victim of homicide. And it makes perfect sense because, as everyone knows, people mostly kill people that they know. Ooh. So if you know too many people, especially in the biblical sense, you could get into a lot of trouble.
Right. Now,
there's a passion.
Now, see, has it all?
This is what I mean when I say everything in my life leads, everything comes in handy.
Well, I was going to ask you, has leading a coffee and crime book club helped you surmise or assess an evildoer in your neighborhood or a plumber that came to the house suspiciously? Or are you more alert to potential red flags because of your reading?
I am suspicious, but then I was born and raised in Manhattan, so it kind of comes with the territory. I did get an extra lock for my house about a year after I started reading all these mystery novels.
You know, I am fascinated by what books mean to you and meant to you. I mean, I mean, did they always have meaning to you? Did they always do something special for you in your life, even as a child?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I was born into a very bookish household. As you know, everybody in my family grew up to be a professor except for me. And my brother, who was the eldest, was an avid reader. So we all, you know, I can remember longing to be able to read, longing. And I really do feel like, and I still have a sense of this at times in a library where I look at all the books and I see them as doors to other places.
I just got chills from that comment.
Well, they are.
Let me ask you something though. We're both old geezers, and to us a book still has some semblance of a physical object. Do you think the same is true? Do you think the same is true if you read it as a Kindle?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm a junkie, so I don't care what the delivery system is. I mean, it is true. I go through different stages, but I also really love audiobooks because, you know, the pleasure of having somebody read aloud to you is replicated in that. And although it's not as intimate, of course, if it's not someone reading to you specially. And also I remember my ex-husband saying to me when I was listening to a book and I was doing, you know, the dishes, and he was saying, is there anything that could not be improved by having a story in the background? And I was like, not too many things. The ones that there are, I can't really mention on this show.
You know, they say that your favorite book as a child ends up being, in a way, the way you live your life. And I found that to be true. I know for me, I used to love, there was a book, you'll probably know this book, two kids accidentally get locked in a museum overnight. And they end up
mixed up files of Mrs. Basile Frankenweiler.
That was it. That was my favorite book.
Great book.
But it took me years to figure out why. And it isn't because eventually I became a storyteller at a history museum. That wasn't it. I realized I always felt safer when I was sort of in hiding. Like, you know, I had a loving home, but it was somehow difficult emotionally. My mother's a Holocaust survivor. And I remember I used to play games in my head where we would be driving on the highway and I would be pretending to hide in a tenement house. Those days they actually had them in the Bronx, where nobody could get at me. My family wouldn't know where to find me. I was always imagining hiding out from relatives and family and people as a safety mechanism. And I realized that book in some ways informed that feeling that I had in myself. So my question to you is, what was your favorite book and how do you think it reflects in your life today?
Well, I want to just comment a little bit about your book because the whole thing about that book is, first of all, they run away to a great place, you know, and they hide in this European bed and it's very fancy. And I remember the heroine says she loves things that are fancy and elegant, and that's so you. She wanted.
Oh, I love that interpretation.
Right. And she also says she wants to run away. She wants to be appreciated. She runs away because she wants to be appreciated, but she doesn't want things to be uncomfortable. And that's so you.
Now I know why they pay you the big bucks in Montclair. You are an analyst. So let's flip the question. Tell me about you. What was your favorite book and how do you think it speaks to your life?
Oh gosh, I really loved so many books. I really did. It's very hard for me to pick one. I think that the first one that came to mind was actually Charlotte's Web, which is such a cliche because the two favorite books of the most librarians in America are Charlotte's Web and A Wrinkle in Time. And those were the two that occurred to me. Well, Charlotte, remember, Charlotte is a word person. She saves Wilbur with words. And she's also a giver. She's someone who serves. And I do agree that one of the things that I really love about being a librarian is that I do get a helper's high from serving people. It's probably pretty different from the CEOs and the brand people that you have on here.
Well, it's interesting that the CEOs and the brand people also get the same high from serving individuals. And you know, we're all human in that way. It's just that they often have to answer to other people, shareholders or, you know, teams. And sometimes some of that gets lost. But in the end, the meaning is always the same. It's always serving individuals and feeling the impact that you have on them. And I guess I was wondering if, obviously, you know, we know you have an impact because people continue to come back and even openly thank you, whether it's email or in person. But have you ever felt a direct impact of a book you've introduced somebody to? For example, maybe you opened a door for them and they responded accordingly. Or was there anything you can think of where you know you've had an impact?
Well, sure. I mean, you know, I think I had the most direct impact when I was working as a school librarian in Newark.
Oh, yeah.
And Newark is what we call a book desert. You know, it has the fewest bookstores of any city its size in America.
Why is that?
I don't know. I mean, I think it has something to do with the fact that you know, Newark is also a food desert. You know, there aren't a lot of groceries there. It doesn't have a great reputation. There's a lot of racism against, you know, immigrants and Black people who live there. So
it's a community with a large immigrant population. And is it also a somewhat poor?
Majority. It's poor and it's majority Black and Hispanic. And there are bookstores there, and the Newark Library does a tremendous job of outreach. And they are really, they do so much with what they've got. But anyway, yeah, I have, you know, when I gave books, that was the best part of that job. Well, the best part of working with kids is always the kids. It's never, you know, like the parents are always, and the school itself, like I didn't enjoy being a disciplinarian. I didn't enjoy that part, but I loved giving books to children and opening their worlds. And the other thing I was going to say when you said to me about books is the idea that a book is both a window and a mirror.
Wow, another chill. Wow. Yes. Yeah. I always feel like a book is makes me less lonely.
Yes. And that's what we mean by communities of readers. Mm-hmm. And certainly before the internet, you know, if you were gay and you were living in Utah or Nebraska, you know, a book was a lifeline. You know, it was the only reassurance you had that you were not the last lone unicorn of your species.
And I just suddenly had a memory when I was a kid in the 60s of all the kind of unhappy housewives in the parents of my classmates that would secretly keep books like The Feminine Mystique or The Happy Hooker in their side table, just to be reminded of what was possible to break out. Yeah.
Well, I can't say that I've ever given anyone the Happy Hooker to open up their world, but I guess it depends on the world that you're living in.
You know, I think the idea of the possibility of roles that, you know, are not the ones you're in. It just opens up the idea of new possibilities. And also for me, you know, I remember when I was unsuccessfully dating and I suddenly picked up Henry Miller. And I thought, oh, I'm kind of dating him now, even though he's not alive. But, you know, I just kind of met these guys that I really like felt like I was dating. And they you know, it was okay that they were not in person. They were just on a page. It still felt very comfortable for me. Vladimir Nabokov, when I read Lolita, it was the only book that ever made me cry, or the first book. But I just remember, even though he was the main character was not a very nice character, the writing was so meaningful to me that I felt like I had a friend.
Yeah, I think what's really remarkable about that book is, speaking of looking at things from the view of a serial killer. I mean, you're looking at things from the view of a serial pedophile. Yeah. And what is so dramatic about that is that he shows us the humanity of the man while not making his crimes seem any the less reprehensible.
That's right. And
it's a little bit to me like Crime and Punishment by Dostoevsky. Mm-hmm. You know, you feel the author makes you feel sorry for, it makes you feel sympathy for this terrible person and humanizes them and allows us to put ourselves in this person's shoes while not making us condone his crimes.
It seems like we could use a lot of that in today's very polarized, you know, environment, and particularly in America. To be able to sit in the shoes of a supposed villain in your neighborhood might reveal something very different. I wish we could use books more to that effect. Maybe you have some ideas in mind about how we can.
I mean, you know, there are a lot of studies here and there that show, not surprisingly, that people who read fiction are more empathetic because they are more interested in that exercise. But what's been really kind of shocking to me as a librarian in today's political atmosphere is that actually seeking information and verifying information and reading nonfiction has become such a political act. And that there are certain people who will just dismiss everything as fake news that they don't want to believe exists. So it's like, no, the earth isn't flat. Fake news. No.
Are you being on the front lines of readership? Are you able to combat any of that in your role?
You know, my community is extremely diverse in a lot of ways, but it's overall very, very progressive. And actually, we present very progressive books, and the books that I choose to promote are progressive. So we're having people from the 1619 Project coming, which is very controversial, to my Open Book, Open Mind online series. It's a re-examination of American history with slavery and race at the core. And it's the expansion of a special issue from the New York Times Magazine section. And the author of the introduction, Nicole Hannah-Jones, won a Pulitzer for her introductory essay. She's not coming, but other major contributors from the book are coming. So we do a lot of books like that, that a lot of other libraries might shy away from. And the way I always see it is, I mean, there's a famous quote, I don't remember who, that a good library has something in it to offend everyone.
I love that.
Right. But, you know, well, people have sometimes asked me, well, why doesn't your library have as many books on creationism as it does on evolution? And the answer is because that's not a mainstream scientific theory.
Ah.
We have some books on creationism or on intelligent design to represent that viewpoint in case someone is interested in exploring it, but we would never highlight that because it's not a mainstream scientific idea.
Well, I can't believe that it's already time to end our interview. I could talk to you for hours. And I'm just so excited that at least one library for sure in the middle of sleepy New Jersey has somebody so important in their community. So I really want to thank you and wish you all the best with all of your upcoming projects, including your Everything Bagel, Everything Book Club, which I hope I can attend one day.
I would love that. And it's always such a pleasure to talk to you, Lisa. You bring out the best in everyone. I think that's your gift.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.